Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is June the 1st, Yom Yerushalayim, and we are in Sefer Daniel. We are in Perek Yud Aleph, Chapter 11, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Verse 21. Let's recap what we have been talking about until now. We have the Malach, the angel, is telling Daniel about the future, and this is one of the, as I mentioned last time, this is an interesting prophecy because many times we see prophecies that have to do with the future that hasn't happened yet, like when Mashiach comes, etc. We had a lot of that in Yechezkel. We had him talking about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which then happened, and then we had him talking about the future with the war of Gog Umagog and the third Beis HaMikdash, etc. And all that we're still waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. And Daniel has had his share of those things as well, of discussions about the distant future. And we'll end the Sefer will end with discussion about the distant future, or hopefully not so distant, but distant from when Daniel lives. But here, we're in the middle of a prophecy that happened several hundred years after Daniel, since Daniel lived between the first and second Beit HaMikdash, between the first and second temples, and he's talking here about the splintering of the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great's empire, and then the ensuing wars between two of the kingdoms that emerged from the kingdom of Greece, and how there was going to be a back and forth and back and forth between the north and the south kingdoms, and we're now entering the point where the Romans get involved. So all of these are prophecies that in Daniel's time were several hundred years ahead of his time, or that were going to happen 700 years in the future. But for us, we know historically they all happened. So it's a different sort of prophecy where it was predicting the future in Daniel's time. But for us, it's already in the past. Now the secular history is that with the splintering of the Alexander the Great's empire, there were several generals who took control, but the main two powerful kingdoms that emerged were the Ptolemaic Empire, actually Ptolemaic Empire, they pronounce it, in the south, that would be in Egypt, and the Seleucid Empire in the north, which was primarily in Syria. Those two empires had a series of wars, which the secular historians call the Syrian Wars. The secular historians they report six Syrian wars over the course of a little over 100 years, from the 4th century before the Common Era to the into the 3rd century before the Common Era, and they report different victories depending on who was winning at that time. Very similar to what Daniel reports over here. In fact, the point Daniel makes back in Pasuk Vav, verse 6, that the daughter of the southern king will come and attempt to make peace by marrying the northern king. That is also reported in the secular history as what ended up happening, and that actually precipitated the second of the Syrian wars. For our purposes, as I mentioned last time, neither side ultimately was great for the Jews, depending on the time. See, there were successive kings in each of the kingdoms. The northern kingdom, that of the Seleucids, so you had various kings, one after the other. Some were better for the Jews, some were worse for the Jews. The southern, the Ptolemaic Empire, as well, there were successive kings. Some were good for the Jews, some were bad for the Jews. But we mentioned last time that the southern kingdom, the Ptolemaic Empire, which the Gemara says is Ptolemy or Ptolemy, that at one point one of those kings was the one who forced the 70 sages to translate the Torah into Greek, and that is the Septuagint. We talked about that at the end of the last class. The northern kingdom, the Seleucid Empire, that is where we have Antiochus. The capital of the northern kingdom was Antioch, and Antiochus, of which there were a few Antiochuses, but Antiochus the IV is what they say in the secular history, was the one who oppressed the Jewish people, which gave rise to the Hanukkah story, which is also reported here in Daniel, as he mentioned towards the end of the last class. That was Pasuk Chaf, that in Pasuk Chaf, verse 20, that there would be a king who would come and throw off the yoke of the northern kingdom from the Jewish people. But that kingdom of the Hashmonaim, the ones who defeated the Syrian Greeks, the Yevonim, the Syrian Greeks, or the Seleucids as they're called in the secular history, their kingdom didn't last that long. It only lasted a few generations. And we talked about last time how they were not supposed to keep the kingdom for themselves because they were from the tribe of Levi. They were Kohanim. And we know that only the tribe of Judah, is supposed to be the kings over the Jewish people. And because they kept the kingdom for themselves, they ended up themselves being wiped out, and the slaves of the Hashmonai family, became the kings over the Jewish people. Eventually there was a civil war between two of the ruling party, and one of them actually brought the Romans in as allies to defeat the other one. And that's how the Romans ended up in Israel before the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Romans were already there, already exercising control, and their control became more and more and more, and that's what we're going to read about tonight, which eventually resulted in the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. But this is all being foretold by Daniel, and the second Beis HaMikdash hasn't even been built yet. And he's telling us all about what will happen with the wars that will take place, and eventually the Hashmonaim, and then the Romans, and the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. It's the Malach is saying it to Daniel, but he's reporting it to us over here. That's right. The Malach, the angel, is telling it to Daniel. That's right. So Pasuk Chaf Aleph, verse 21, referring to the rise of the Roman influence in Israel. The Amad Al Kano Nivzeh, and they will stand on his akan as a base, like something that holds something else up. Nivzeh, someone who is that's a good translation for nivzeh.
Contemptible.
Okay. A little too fancy for me, but yes, someone who is contemptible. That this contemptible person, meaning the king of the Romans, will rise in power. Flo nasnu alav hod malchus, and they will have not given him the glory of royalty. Uvavishalva, he will come in peace. Vehechazik malchus, and he will take control of the kingdom. Bachalak lakos, with chalak lakos means softness or smoothness, which means he will be a sweet talker, and he will manage to sweet talk his way into power within Israel. This is not referring to the Roman rise to power in Rome and in and around Rome, but it is referring to the Romans now gaining a foothold in Eretz Israel. And that will be done not through war, but through being invited in by the one of the two brothers who was involved in the civil war to join in to help him with defeating his brother. Uzraos hashetef
Yishatfu milafanav v'yishavelu. And the previous, the strong ones, the great powerful powers, they will be inundated from before him and they will be broken. V'gam nigid bris. And also the king of the Jews, which is, he's called Negid, which means king, bris of the covenant. Because what will happen is that the king of the Jews is going to make a treaty or a pact with the Roman Empire, and eventually that will be his downfall. But so this pasuk is saying that the Romans are going to come in, they came in, and they were able to sweep away the other powers of the region, and even the one with whom they made a covenant, which because what we're going to see is going to happen is that they're going to break the covenant. There was a covenant made that the Jewish king made a pact with the Roman king, but in the end, the Roman king is going to break the pact. Let's just get the names straight, because I keep saying the Jewish king. I mentioned last time the two brothers who were warring were Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Those were the two kings, the two brothers. They are Greek names, as they sound. And I keep forgetting who's the one on the outside, who's the one on the inside. It was was it Hyrcanus on the outside? One of the brothers was inside Yerushalayim, the other brother was outside Yerushalayim.
After 12-year reign, Seleucus IV was assassinated by his chief minister, Heliodorus, with different people.
No, that's the Seleucids. That doesn't help us for the Jews.
Totally.
For the Jews, hold on. One second, we'll get this straight. Yeah. Aristobulus was the one outside Yerushalayim. Hyrcanus was inside Yerushalayim. Aristobulus went and got the Romans to join him to defeat his brother. And he, Aristobulus, made a pact with the Romans, but eventually the Romans are going to break the pact. And they will eventually destroy the Beis HaMikdash, not in Aristobulus' time, but in the time of a descendant of his who will be king at that time. The pasuk continues.
Chaf Gimel, yeah.
Who was their father?
Yes.
They come from the Hordus line, from the Herod line, but I don't know who their father was.
The tribe was.
Not tribe. They were slaves.
They're slaves.
They are slaves. They were non-Jews who were taken as slaves by the Hashmonaim. Let's review that. We say every morning that we make a bracha. We bless Hashem, Shelo Asani Goy. He did not make me a non-Jew. And Shelo Asani Aved. He didn't make me a slave. What is a slave? So a slave is a non-Jew who becomes a slave owned by a Jew. That non-Jew undergoes a forced conversion and has to keep mitzvos like a Jew. And if that slave is ever freed, then they become a full-fledged Jew. As long as they're still a slave, then a regular Jew is not allowed to marry them. They're a slave. They can marry other slaves, but they cannot marry another Jew. If they're ever freed, then they become regular Jews. That's a forced conversion. For a Jew to own a non-Jew and not have the non-Jew go through a forced conversion, the Gemara says is permitted, but only for a short time. But not for a long period of time, because the Gemara says we do not want Jews having non-Jewish slaves in their household, acting as non-Jews living in a Jewish home, because that will bring in an influence to the home that is unacceptable, and so the non-Jewish slave has to be forced to convert. And is a slave as a Jew, and they are obligated in mitzvos as a regular Jew is. That's what it means of it. That's what it means a slave. The how does one acquire a slave? How does that happen? The most common way a slave is acquired is through being a POW, a prisoner of war. In today's day and age, they don't know what to do with prisoners of war. That's how you end up with Guantanamo Bay. In the time of Chazal, prisoners of war were slaves. That's what happened. If you lost the war and you were conquered, then if you were in the army and you were captured, then that person becomes a slave. That was common practice across the board. And when that would happen, those slaves were as I said, were kept by the Jews. If the Jews won a war, then they had slaves, and those slaves were there was a forced conversion. When we say Shalosh Ani Avin, that we thank Hashem He didn't make me a slave, that's what we're referring to. When the Hashmonaim were killed out, they owned slaves. It was one of the slaves who rebelled against them who killed them out. That was Hurdus. That was Herod. And then his line became the royal family, but they were slaves. So the Jews ended up, it was an ironic thing, that the Jews ended up being ruled by slaves.
How many of these forced conversions would really stick? I mean, I would think that if someone's forced to do something, as soon as they're free, they'd say, yeah, right, you know, I'm going my own way.
That's because you live in the year 2011. In previous years, there was no such thing. Slaves were slaves. They had no choice. They did what they were told to do. And, you know, that's the way it was. And they were rarely freed.
And so not, even when he becomes king, he's not freed?
He's not, well, that's a discussion whether there would be a freedom. He was never given any freedom. He killed his masters. So there's no one to free him anymore. Those who owned him were dead.
But by the act of killing your master and taking over the country, that kind of frees you.
That's a discussion whether that's true or not true.
I don't mean obligation to God. I mean free your lifestyle. When
yeah, for sure. That. He for sure had a freer lifestyle. He was the king. Right.
So, yeah. The one that has the all in the air, is that?
No, that's a Jewish slave.
That's a Jewish slave?
That's a Jew owned by a Jew. That's a Jew owned by a Jew. A Jew who either sells himself as a slave to another Jew, or who steals and does not have how to pay back. So the court sells him to another Jew. That's a 6-year tenure of slavery. And he's a full-fledged Jew, but he has to work, and he works for free. He works for his master, and at the end of that 6 years, he is automatically freed. If he wants to continue as a slave, then they pierce his ear, and he is a slave until Yovel, until the 50th year. And that's always the ironic thing, that there's no such thing as a woman being a slave up until Yovel. Only a man can be a slave up until Yovel. A woman who could be sold, it's for sure not more than 6 years. But a man, if he wants to continue, can go until Yovel, until up to the 50th year.
I thought a non-Jewish woman that was given...
No, Jewish, we're talking about right now. Jewish woman. So the ironic thing is that a man who has his ear pierced is a sign of slavery.
Uh-huh.
That's an important thing to be aware of. Yes?
So the Jewish person could keep the slaves... the non-Jew indefinitely as a slave?
And his children, and his children's children, and his children's children's children, all the way down. It's a slave family.
I guess the only good thing about it was they could either kill him or take him as a slave. So I guess being a slave, it might be better.
They had rights. You weren't allowed to abuse the slave.
Right.
They had
rights, and they were treated pretty well.
Certainly better than the slaves in the rest of the world. That's for sure. That's another question. Yeah.
So this non-Jewish slave is forced to convert. He becomes a Jewish slave, right?
Well, he becomes a slave. He gets the status of slave when he's forced to convert. He's not a Jewish slave, meaning he's not someone who was a Jew who became a slave. That's a different status. There's Eved Ivri, that's a Jew who becomes a slave. That's the 6-year thing, and then if he wants to go to the Yovel year. And then there is a non-Jew, who that's called a non-Jewish slave, but when he's forced to convert, he has halachos like a Jew. The truth is, it's not 100% like a Jew. He is obligated in mitzvos the same way that a woman is obligated in mitzvos. Meaning that
he is not obligated in time-bound mitzvos. Just like a woman is not obligated in time-bound mitzvos. But he is obligated in all of the prohibitions.
And is he supposed to study Torah?
He does not have to study Torah, not as a slave. Not as a slave.
Let's say in those times,
mm-hmm.
you said that you don't want a Gentile to live among the Jews. So he becomes a Jew through a false conversion.
Through a forced conversion.
How does a Gentile suddenly,
They have to tell him what to do. They have to tell him the rules. But remember, he is a slave. It's very hard for us to understand a slave mentality. But slaves were slaves. They did as they were told.
I just don't understand what does it look like?
They're not allowed to do work on Shabbos.
Right.
Right. They are not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur. They're
But how does that make a difference? I hear you that they're following these laws, but he's a Gentile person. He's not a Jewish.
No, he can never go back to being a Gentile.
Does he have a bris mentality still?
Yeah, he has a bris.
Well, then you're left. Well, you have a bris, but he's still a Gentile living. You're forced to be, right? Now, he's forced.
It wasn't. He didn't think it was great. He didn't think being a slave was great.
Right.
But he didn't have a choice.
Right. But how does it make him a Jew living in a Jewish home? Just because
if he would deliberately go against the Torah, he would be punished like any Jew would be punished. If he did something that the punishment was lashes, he would get lashes, just like any Jew.
But the slave murdered his master and became a king.
You're talking about this particular case. No, I agree. No, but
I'm so baffled by this particular case.
We'll get back to it. But Clary's asking in general about slavery, right?
Yeah.
You're not asking about this specific case.
What does it look like to have? Because I imagine there must have been. There were a lot of wars, so we must have had a lot of slaves.
I don't know how many there actually were. I mean, I'm sure there were, but I don't know how many. I don't know, historically, everybody had slaves. So I don't know how common it was. But let me just address Mrs. Lewis's question. The when he rebelled, so it was the beginning of the end of the Jewish monarchy. Now, that's what was happening over there. The Jewish government was crumbling. The Jews, we had been under the rule of the Persians, which then gave rise to being under the rule of the Greeks, and then we were shuttled back and forth between the Ptolemaic Empire and the Seleucid Empire. Finally, the Hasmonaim managed to throw off the yoke, and that lasted for a few generations. And then, when the slave rebellion happened, so then that was already, edging towards the destruction of the Second Base of America. Things were falling apart. So they didn't have any power at that time. There was no Jewish court that had any power to deal with that slave that rebelled. He took control.
Don't you think a relative who saw that their relative was killed by a slave would exact justice?
There were no more relatives. All of the Hasmonaim were killed out.
Except for the woman.
Right, that's right. Every single one was killed out.
And it was okay for her to commit suicide?
He was going to keep her around for his own use. So, I don't know what that would...
That might have been one of the three things.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. The Gemara doesn't fault her. She was a young girl. The Gemara doesn't fault her for doing it.
So could the Jewish people be part of that slave? Could we be part of?
Could there be a descendant amongst us, someone who comes later? It could be, and we just lost the line. It's possible. It's possible.
The ones we would know not are the Kohanim. They're pure strength. But the rest
we assume so.
Could have been from those forced conversions.
It's possible. It's possible. We go with the majority. The majority of Jews, we certainly would not be from that. What will happen in the future, I don't know. I'm not worried about it. Yeah.
Well, two things. It would be difficult to have a household with someone who is not Jewish living in the household, and they could change things in the house that would make it not kosher.
Mm-hmm.
So there, it's, you know, that sort of thing, married in name only.
Well, that's why they had
to. I don't know how willing they were.
Once they were converted, they had to keep kosher.
Yeah, they had to keep kosher. Well, according to us, but.
They were slaves.
If they left and they were still Jewish, what kind of Jew could they be if they were forced into it?
If they were freed. Regular full fledged converts.
But how does one know that they aren't yearning for their old life or something?
Is that why it always says the orphan and the widow and the proselyte, you must not take advantage of those three?
A proselyte is any convert. It could be a slave who was then freed.
Is that where that comes from, though? From way back there, that we had to have a
No, because any... What about a regular convert? Any convert would fit that description. If they're compassion for any convert.
Self-willed convert.
So what's the difference? Remember, any convert doesn't own land in an agricultural society. Most converts were destitute. How do they have a business? How do they have money? They came without any land.
No particular tribe.
So the Torah says you got to take care of them.
But what's common to take slaves from a war because, and this, sometimes a war could be started because of that.
That's true.
Because they would need workers in the field or this or that.
It could happen.
So they would, kind of start something so that they could possibly win somebody over and take slaves. But that's not unusual in a lot of ancient societies.
Right.
And actually, the Arabs of Israel could be our slaves.
I don't know about you.
Well, I'm just thinking.
There's
one
war
in here and all these people.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, I don't know how it would apply today. Today, today the world at large doesn't deal with slavery, so I'm not sure, you know.
So wait, when Noah's son is cursed that he will be the slave of slaves, what does that mean then in this kind of context? Because that would mean that eventually, if they became slaves to Jewish people, they would become Jews. So they can no longer be slaves of slaves because now they're Jews.
They can only become Jews if they were freed. And it was rare to free. The Torah says you're not supposed to free a slave for no reason. The Torah says there is a pasuk in the Torah, a verse in the Torah that says not to free slaves unless there's a specific reason to do so.
Okay, so when his son was given that curse, it meant all time, forever.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a case in the Gemara, which your question was, what would be a reason to free a slave? There's a case in the Gemara that there were 9 men for a minion, mm-hmm. and 1 slave.
Master
freed him to have a minion.
Oh, wow. Well, what about the moral and ethical?
The Gemara discusses whether that's a good reason or a bad reason. But, you know.
What about the moral and ethical? We are moral and ethical people. Why is it okay to take a slave? We're not taking someone.
That's something which is going to get us
freedom
away. Yeah, that's a little too far afield to go in this particular context. The Torah clearly condones slavery. You find it throughout the Torah. Whether when Mashiach comes, that we will say that, well, you know, society has moved beyond that, so we won't do it anymore. That's very possible. But the POW problem is a real issue. What do you do? You have two choices. You defeat a nation. There's a nation that's fighting with you. And you defeat the nation, so you beat them. So now you've got 10,000 able-bodied men, strong, right? What do you do with them? So you have three choices: either you mow them down, slaughter them right there. That's pretty barbaric. Or you send them home, in which case next year they're going to fight with you again because you sent them home. So what do you do with them? So you take them as slaves. It's a very pragmatic way of dealing with the problem.
But who do they marry?
They would marry other women slaves. That would be the.
When you take the man as a slave, are you also taking his family back home?
If they were also in the war.
Not they just their family back home are left behind and they're marrying someone else, and so then their new wife and all the children are owned by the Jew.
Well, the new wife, right.
New wife, yeah. So you're not separating the family, so that's something ethical. You're not separating the family.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
If you're going
to
rationalize.
Yep. It's complicated. So what is the woman also is forced to be, this woman slave is also forced to be Jewish?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But so
the,
I mean,
the same way that the male slave is, that neither one has
the Yeah. Yeah. Look, it's slavery. It's slavery, and most people today are not comfortable with slavery. But it's slavery. What you do have to bear in mind is that the way they were treated was far better with us than with anybody else. And remember also, when it comes to female slaves, that female slaves were routinely molested by their masters, and that was not so when Jews owned slaves, because the Torah prohibits it. So, I mean, you could have a Jew who's not keeping the Torah, but Jews who kept the Torah didn't do that because it's expressly prohibited in the Torah. So there was a certain degree of civility and a certain amount of rights that they had, which was not the case in the world at large. So, you know, I can't tell you anything that's going to make you feel comfortable with the whole notion of slavery, but I can tell you that things were far better in Israel if you were a slave in Israel than if you were anywhere else. That's for sure.
Well, could the Jewish owner, male, take a Jewish slave, convert it, and as a wife?
Could you mean a non-Jew?
It wouldn't be a non-Jew if she was forced.
Yeah, he could free her and marry her, yeah. But it would be her choice. Once he freed her, she doesn't have to marry him.
Yeah.
He can't force her to marry him. Okay. And as long as she's a slave, he's prohibited to her. Once he frees her, she's free. So it's her choice.
She could say, oh, I really like you. I really like you. Goodbye.
That would be pretty crafty. But yeah, you know.
Was there an official ceremony to free, like in front of
there's a document that is given to a slave, which, believe it or not, is no, not a ketubah. Not a ketubah. Just the opposite. The slave, a get. The slave document of freedom is most analogous to a get, to a divorce document, because the slave is becoming separated from the master. It's a very similar type of document. It's taking two entities and splitting them. That's what is happening with that. So that when the Gemara discusses one document, it discusses the other document as well. It's very similar rules for the documents.
Well, it's in the South, when I have read about the Civil War, when slaves were freed, sometimes they didn't leave at all from the house because they didn't know what to do.
They didn't know
where
to go. Right, what are you going to do?
Where are we going to go?
Immediately after the Emancipation Proclamation, the slaves, they were free, they celebrated, and then what? They went right back to their masters and went back to be paid for nothing, to work crazy hours because they had no education. They know, what were they going to do?
Well, some owners did educate their slaves. Those, I think, went on. But, you know, that was what was wrong with that particular kind of history.
Right, but
they didn't give them any training or anything.
Right. But that's where we have to be very thankful when it comes to Pesach, the way Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. The way Hashem took us out of Egypt, He did not take us out and say, okay, you're free, now figure out what to do. He actually gave us dignity. He gave us direction. He gave us connection. He gave us nationhood. He gave us a land.
He gave us a plan.
He gave us a plan. I mean, he really, you know, He took us out and set us up. He didn't just, okay, you're free.
But for a man to take a woman that he wanted to convert to be a slave, doesn't that she have let her fingernails grow long and be on camp for about a month or so until before he...
That's not a slave. That's if a man takes a woman in a war and wants to marry her. And wants to marry her. That was also a form of civility, because with the world at large, if a man is in war, encounters a woman, there's no rules. He does whatever he wants. But the Torah demands that if a man does want to take a woman that he meets in war, then he has very specific rules he has to follow, and it has to result in a marriage, in a real marriage, or he has to let her go free.
But she has to convert somewhere, sir.
Yeah, well, there would have to be a conversion along the way. But
that is addressing a situation that in war, what happens is in war, people lose their sense of civility, their sense of their just the basic dignity. People lose it. The whole act of running around killing people, which you have to do in war, it makes a person, it just brings out their animalistic side, and they lose their whole sense of spirituality, their whole sense of direction. That's what happens. It happens in any war. So in that situation, so when the conquering army comes in and there's women, then it's terrible what goes on. So the Torah imposes rules for how things are done, and it has to result in a marriage, or he has to let it go for it.
I guess another area I'm still having trouble with this. Last time you said that you're not supposed to teach a non-Jew Torah.
Correct.
But you're forcing these people to become Jews, so you are going to be teaching them the Torah that they need to know, right?
Once they're Jews, it's fine.
But you're forcing them to convert. So there's a point in time when they're still not before they know enough to become. Right?
Teach them along the way.
No, I'm just saying, so, and even nowadays, you know, we're just so ingrained, you know, that you leave the goyim alone, let them have their happy lives, let them, you know, keep the Noahide laws, and this just really goes in the face of that. Even if a man finds a woman in war, he's forcing her to convert and then forcing her to marry him. I mean, there's a lot of forcefulness that we're not accustomed to.
Hey, war is not fun. War is not, you know. War is not. You got it. You know. War is not.
I'm not saying though. That's important. Because it refers to today as well. And that is, if you force people to convert, take a slave and you force them to convert, today, you don't want them to convert.
Well, even,
not without rejecting...
Well, even then, they didn't want... Even then, a person who came to convert willingly was discouraged, just like today. But we discouraged slaves. I mean, discouraged...
So someone would say, I want to become a Jew, and then they'd have to be discouraged.
No.
This is all in context of war. You can't take it out of context. This is in context of war and taking the POWs. Well, that's a fighting word.
Okay. Got a little sidetracked. Anybody who is trying out our Sefer Daniel classes and trying this one for the first one, you feel a little... At any rate, so again, Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22 was the fact that the Roman king was going to eventually break the covenant that he made with Aristobulus. Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23, Umin hischabrus elav ya'aseh mirma, and from his connection with him, he will act with trickery. Ve'ala ve'atzam bim'at goy, and he will go up, and he will be powerful, but only with a few people. Goy here means, it means nation, but it means with just few in number. The Roman presence was not large. They didn't need a lot of people, because since it was being done through treaties and through promises, so they didn't have to have a large garrison. There was some Romans who came into Israel, but it was not huge. B'shalva uvemishmane medina yavo, with serenity and with
delectable.
Who? Delectable what?
No,
that's
part of
the country.
Is that what it says?
That's part of the country.
Who?
Richest
part of the country. Okay, he will come. Okay. Va'asa ashalo asu avosav, va'avos avosav. He will do what his ancestors did not do, neither the ancestors of his ancestors. Biza v'shalol urakush lahem yivzor. Booty and spoils that he will give to the people. See, Rashi explains what they did is that as they would conquer, they would give out the spoils of the war to those that they conquered, which would make those that they conquered happy that they had been conquered, because now they became wealthier. Ve'al mivtzarim yechashev machshevosav ve'ad eis, and And then he would make his calculations on fortified cities, and it would be until a time, which means it would keep on going until the time where it's going to, as we'll see later, what's going to happen at the end of this whole conquering system of the Romans. Then this Roman king will raise up his strength and his heart against the southern king. The southern king is still the Ptolemaic kingdom. Because although they are going to come into Israel, and remember, in Israel they had thrown off the yoke of the Yevanim, of the Syrian Greeks, the Seleucid Empire, but there still is the southern empire to deal with, which is the Ptolemaic Empire. So he will now turn his attention there. B'chayil gadol, with a lot of with a large army, Umelech HaNegev, and the king of the south, Yisgarel HaMilchama B'chayil gadol v'yotzumad ma'od. He will also prepare himself for war with a large army and very, very powerful. V'lo yamod, but he will not last. Ki achshavu alav ma'chashavos, because they will consider ways against him. The southern king will lose the battle, because the Romans will figure out ways, crafty ways of defeating him. As Rashi explains, they will encourage rebellion and civil war in the southern kingdom. And those who eat from his table will break him, the southern king. And his army will be inundated, will be swept away. And many corpses will fall. Now, so far, we're still dealing with a Roman king that is working in tandem with the Jewish king, with either Aristobulus or his descendants. Ushnehem ha-melachim, and both those kings, the Roman king and the Jewish king, levavam le-meira, their hearts will be for evil, v'al shuchan echad kazav yedaberu, and on one table they will speak lies and trickery, v'lo sitzlach, but it will not be successful. Meaning, for the Jewish king, it will not be successful. He owed Kate Flamboyant, for there is still an end of the time that's going to come. V'yashov artso b'rchush gadol. So after this defeat of the Ptolemaic kingdom, the Roman king will go back to his land with great wealth. Ulevavav al-bris kodesh. But his heart will be towards the covenant that he had with the Jewish king, which means his heart will be looking for a way of double-crossing his Jewish ally. V'asa v'shav la'artzo. He will do it, and he will come back to his land. So far, there still is some sort of alliance between the Jews and the Romans. La'moed, but to a time, yashuv uva b'negev. He will then return to the south and have another war with the southern king, with the Ptolemaic kingdom. But this time, it will not be like the first war, nor like the most recent war. Meaning that the Roman king will not have as much success as he did before battling the Ptolemaic kingdom in the south. And will come against him these various groups will fight against him, against the Roman king. Vishav vizaam albris kodesh v'asa. So then he will go back, and he will now double-cross the covenant that he had with the Jews. Vishav v'yavein al ozei bris kodesh. And he will go back, and he will understand about those who left the Holy Covenant. As Rashi explains, the Roman king was afraid to double-cross the Jews, because he knew that as long as the Jews are keeping the Torah, it's a very difficult thing to defeat the Jewish people. Remember, the Hashmonaim, who defeated the Yevanim, who defeated the Greeks, who defeated the Seleucids, Antiochus, they did so because they were tzaddikim, they were righteous. And they won wars in a way that was supernatural. It was totally beyond what anybody expected, that these, as we say on Hanukkah, Rabim biyad ma'atim, the many in the hands of the few, Giborim biyad chalashim, the strong in the hands of the weak. This was not lost on the Romans. They saw that the Jews won wars that no one should have been able to win. And therefore, the Romans were afraid to double-cross the Jews. But when they looked carefully and saw that the Jewish people were no longer keeping the Torah properly, then they weren't afraid anymore to double-cross the Jews. Uziroim mimenu ya'amodu, and powerful ones from him will come up. V'chimlu ha-mikdash, and they will defame the mikdash, the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. Hama'oz, ha-mikdash hama'oz, the kingdom, the temple, the strong temple. V'siru ha-tamid, and they will remove the carbon tamid, the carbon, the sacrifice that was brought every day, morning and night. V'nasnu ha-shikutz mishomem, and they would bring in the idols. U'mashie v'ris, and those who went against the covenant, meaning the Jews who did wrong, who the Jews who were not keeping the Torah, Yachanif Bachalakos, he will
flatter.
I couldn't think of the word. Thank you. Flatter. What's that?
Glibly.
Okay. It means smoothly. He was a sweet talker again. That he brought in to his side, he took all the Jews who were not keeping the Torah and had them join his forces. And those, the nation that did know their God, meaning the tzaddikim, they tried to be strong and keep the Torah. So there was a group of Jews who would continue to try to keep the Torah. Umaskile am, this is referring to the Talmidei Chachamim, the sages of the nation. Yavinu l'rabim, they would try to make known to the masses, they would try to continue to teach Torah. V'nichshalu b'cherev u'v'lahava, but they would trip up with the sword and with fire. Bishvi, with being taken captive, u'viza, and spoils yamim, for days. So what is being described is that as the Romans came in and they noticed that the Jews were no longer keeping the Torah as they should, they got those Jews who had forsaken the Torah to join the Roman side. The Talmidei Chachamim, the sages, tried to hold on as long as they could, continued to teach Torah. As we know, many were martyred. Rabbi Akiva is the quintessential example where he was teaching Torah despite the Roman decree prohibiting the teaching of Torah, and eventually he was captured and eventually was killed in a horrible way, executed in a horrible way.
So that whole thing is taking place.
And this is what's being described. The destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, all the martyring that was going on, a lot of the sages being killed, that's what's being described over here. Ubihi kashlam, and as they tripped up, Ye'azru ezer ma'at, they will be helped a little bit. Rashi says that that they will be able to bribe some of the officials, etc., and be able to be helped a little bit. I'll explain that in a moment. V'nilvu aleihem rabim b'chalak lakos, and many will join them again. With this word chalak lakos, which means with smooth talking or with sweet talking, so there will, although the sages will have a lot of trouble with the destruction and all of the gullus, all the exile that's happening, there will be though some degree of letting up of the troubles, and they will have some ability to continue the Torah. This is likely referring to those short spurts of time during the Roman reign over Israel, where there was some degree of allowing the Jews to study the Torah and to keep their religion, and that led to the ability for the Mishnayos to be compiled. Rashi explains in Maseches Bava Metzia that from the time that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, until the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who is the one who compiled the Mishnah, there was never a time that the sages, the remaining sages, could actually get together and compare notes. Because everybody was in hiding, everybody was running, everybody was trying, it was very difficult. There was no way that the sages of the time could get together, because it was strictly prohibited by the Romans to be studying Torah publicly, and certainly not to have a conference of sages. This went on for several generations, including the generation of Rabbi Akiva, as we know, who was martyred, and his students, and on. But the Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who is the second generation after Rabbi Akiva, so Rabbi Akiva's students, that's where Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi fits in. In his day, as Rashi explains, Antoninus became the Caesar in Rome, and he developed a beautiful relationship with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. He liked Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, took a liking to him, and he allowed the sages to get together. And when that happened, the sages got together, it was the first time that they had a chance to breathe since the destruction of the temple. And they were able, this was already over 100 years after the destruction of the temple, they were able to get together and compare notes, and the body of the Mishnah was compiled. And that becomes the main body of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law.
What's his name?
Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Would you?
That's no.
The Caesar?
To...
Antoninus is what the Gemara says. Antoninus. Antonius, right. Antoninus is what the Gemara says. They had a very nice relationship. They had a personal relationship, the two of them.
Is that the Antoninus who was nursed by...
That's correct. Name? Exactly right. I don't know if anybody remember that story. Right. That's right.
There's also some debate about whether he may have converted.
Right. At the end of his life, he may have converted. It's not clear. He definitely... It was. He knew, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi knew, they both knew that once Antoninus would die, this period of serenity would end. That those who succeeded Antoninus would not be interested in the Jews having the same type of freedoms that they did under Antoninus. They both knew that. And the Gemara relates a story where Antoninus was smuggling money to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Now, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a very wealthy man. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi told Antoninus, I don't need the money. I have plenty of money. I don't need your money. So Antoninus said, keep it, because with the money I'm giving you, that's how your successors will bribe my successors. They both knew that they needed to prepare for the future.
Is that the closing of the canon? At the end of...
No, the canon, that's earlier. That's scripture. That's earlier. That's with the end of the second... That's with the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. That's when that closes. This is talking about Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral Torah, which was written down with the Mishnah. The first time it was written down in an official body was the Mishnayos. That was around the year 190 or so. And then 300 years later is when the Gemara, the Talmud, was compiled. And that's later. One more pasuk. Umin amaskilim yikashlu, and from the sages they would trip up. Litzrof bahem ulevorer velalbein ades kates. So the sages this pasuk lamed hey 35 is already on a different note. The truth is, we're probably going to start with this again next week. But this is referring to, as Rashi explains, that now that they are in Golos, they're in exile with the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. Now everybody is trying to figure out, when will the Golos end? As we discussed with Daniel, that he had so many predictions over here, and that it was that figuring out the when it would end was something which goes on and on. It's constantly tried, and there's failure and failure and failure. And this pasuk is referring to that from the sages, Yikashli would trip up Litzrof Bahem to try to figure them out, Lavarar Valalbain, and to make it clear and to make it understandable, Ades Kates, when would be the end? Ki Od Lamoid, for it is still to come. There's still time to come. So as we talked about, that Hashem has set it up where we have these predictions, and they're enticing. We want to know when it's going to end. So anybody would want to try to figure it out, and certainly someone who is a sage and knows a lot of the background and knows a lot of the information and knows how to read these things would certainly be encouraged to try. And that goes on in every generation. People try to figure it out, but of course everybody fails. But that's something which Hashem wants, as we talked about, because it keeps the concept of Mashiach and the future alive, as everybody is trying to figure it out. Somebody's going to get it right eventually, but that's what comes up. Now, there is now going to be a paradigm shift in Daniel. Until now, the angel has been telling him predictions about the few hundred year history of the second Beis HaMikdash and the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, with the, as we said, with the Greek Empire and its splintering, and the wars back and forth, and the Hashmonaim, and the Hanukkah story, and then the Romans, destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, etc. All that is going on. From here on, Lamed Vav 36, as we read on, now, without telling us so, I only know this from having read Rashi, we are now going to switch into a discussion of the future that hasn't happened yet. The future with the war of Gog Umagog, which we discussed in Yechezkel as well. And now we're going to switch into that. So, because now he's fast-forwarding to when the end of the second, of this Golos, of this exile, is going to happen. Because we don't know when it's going to happen, but we do know events that are supposed to happen towards the end. And so he's now going to switch into some of those events. And that's, Mir Sashem, we're going to discuss next time. Yeah.
Is this prophecy by the angel also prophesizing the beginning of the fall of the Roman Empire?
Of the fall, he doesn't say anything here about the fall of the Roman Empire. Daniel mentioned it before, when we had several prophecies about the various, remember, the, like the monster, and the, you know, there was predictions about the fall of the Roman Empire, but here it doesn't say anything about it.
No, it doesn't say anything, but I'm just wondering if the time frame, that's saying.
Well, it went, I mean...
Well, the predictions that the fall of the Roman Empire...
Daniel doesn't give a time frame for it, for the fall of the Roman Empire. He doesn't give a time frame for it.
Does he predict Christianity?
It does not appear to be in Daniel. At least I haven't seen it. I'm sure if you read it deeply enough, you might find it. But you have a question?
Just trying to remember what I was going to ask you. Yeah. So, is there any view that says that Gog and Magog was the Holocaust?
It could be. There's no way for me to know. We can surmise, right? But there's no way to know for sure. When Mashiach comes, it will be clear. There's a lot that will become clear then, that, a lot of things that are shrouded in a mystery now, but we don't know. Next week is Shavuos night, so we will not be meeting next week on the 8th, so our next class is going to be on the 15th, and as I mentioned to you, my plan is to be finishing Sefer Daniel, if not on the, probably not on the 15th, it probably will be on the 22nd. What I would like to do is plan, we have the 15th, probably the 22nd as well, and then most likely we would plan a Siyum for Sefer Daniel for the following week, for the 29th. That's probably how we'll look it out.
Still being put on the computer, right?
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.